All right, on to chapter 8. More enzyme stuff. This is about inhibitors, mostly. Inhibitors of enzymes, that is. Enzymes either work or don't. Well, I shouldn't say it that way. Enzymes have a range of how well they work, but they are proteins, right? And any given protein, whatever its function is, has that specific function because of its shape. Enzymes can be caused to not function well because of a change in shape, therefore. And you already knew this before today. I'm not showing you anything you don't know here with this graph in slide one. Here we have enzyme activity plotted versus temperature. Now, if you think about whatever reaction this enzyme catalyzes, of course, the enzyme isn't necessary, right? Catalyzed reactions can also occur even without the help of the catalyst. It wouldn't be a catalyzed reaction then, but it would proceed uncatalyzed, just not nearly as fast, right? So if you think about it, the reaction system with in the absence of the enzyme, usually an increase in temperature will increase the rate of that uncatalyzed reaction, right? Why is that? The enzyme's not there. I'm saying in uncatalyzed. But otherwise, you're right. If you have at least in certain reactions. If you have a reaction that has two reactants, right? Those reactants have to encounter each other definitely for the reaction to proceed. And that's going to happen more often the faster particles are moving around, right? This, in general, is why solution chemistry that's occurring in solution happens a lot more quickly than just reactants in solid form sitting around, because there's just a lot more collisions between reactants. And that's why life is solution chemistry. But if you assume you have a solution and therefore you have particles moving around, encountering each other, bouncing off of each other, they're going to bounce off of each other more often if the average speed of those particles is greater. Well, that's what temperature is an indication of, right? Temperature is an indication of the average speed of the particles of whatever sample you're measuring the temperature of. It's different from heat, right? Heat is the total energy content. It's an extensive property. The more stuff you have, the more heat you have. Temperature is an intensive property. It's just a measurement of the average speed of the particles, and therefore it doesn't matter how big the sample is. But if the average speed, even though all the particles are going at a different speed, if the average speed is higher, if the temperature is higher, then that means it's going to be more likely that two particles are going to encounter each other at that when everything's moving faster than when everything's moving slower. So if we now consider that same reaction, but with the help of the enzyme, it makes sense that an enzyme would do its job even better because it has to involve collisions, has to involve the meeting up between substrate or substrates and whatever the enzyme is. So it should also improve in performance with an increase in temperature, right? And that's why you see the upward slope on the graph. But it doesn't continue indefinitely, right? It has a precipitous fall at a certain temperature, which depends on the enzyme, and what's happening there. Denaturation of the enzyme. Enzymes are proteins. Proteins have their function based on shape. Shape is due to mostly non-covalent interactions between residues of the polypeptide or polypeptides making up that protein, right, as we've discussed. Those are comparatively weak interactions. Weak interactions can be disrupted fairly easily if you knock things into it fast enough. In other words, at high temperature. So temperature is one of those variables in the environment that really can have a drastic effect on the function of proteins in general, but most of your proteins are enzymes. And that's the main reason why we defend our body temperature so, can't think of an adverb here, but we do defend it. It's part of thermostasis, in other words, is part of homeostasis, at least in animals like we are. We are homeotherms, which means we maintain a body temperature. We can't tolerate our body temperature going either up or down too far out of the normal range, like a poikilotherm does. Slide 2 shows you a graph simultaneously for two different enzymes, pepsin and chymotrypsin. We've talked about both of these enzymes before. What are they examples of? They are what? They are digestive, but more specifically than that. So as digestive enzymes, they're catabolic enzymes, which means they dismantle some sort of chemical, right? They break it into smaller chunks. They are peptidases, right? They are proteolytic, which is another word that describes the same thing, really, right? Proteolytic means breaking proteins. They do it in slightly different ways, but they are both breaking peptide bonds in order to dismantle the proteins that they operate on as substrates. Notice, though, that the two different traces peak out at totally different values of X, which in this graph is not temperature, but pH. And that makes sense because of the origin, the anatomical origin of these two different enzymes. They're secreted from different places. Pepsin actually isn't secreted directly, but where do we see pepsin work? In the stomach. In fact, peptic is a word that means of the stomach, right? But the stomach cells don't actually secrete pepsin. The cells that make the enzyme the stuff that turns into pepsin make what is called a proenzyme, pepsinogen, which is in an inactive form, which is good because the stomach cells have a lot of protein in them, right? It's dangerous stuff to have a proteolytic enzyme around. So pepsinogen is secreted into the stomach, and then when it's put into the environment of that gastric lumen, the hollow part of the stomach, which features a very low pH, that's going to transform that pepsinogen, that proenzyme, into the active form, pepsin, where it then does its job of breaking down some of the proteins that are in the chyme. C-H-Y-M-E is the stuff we call food after it reaches the stomach. So this graph makes sense because compared to most places in the body, the gastric lumen has a much lower pH. What you see by this graph is simply that pepsin works best, has an optimal pH that actually matches its natural environment. Because of that's the way natural selection works in general, right? Things get optimized in natural selection. Same is true for chymotrypsin, though, but that's not secreted by the stomach. That's a pancreatic enzyme. Pancreas is a dual organ, a dual gland. It is both endocrine and exocrine. So it secretes insulin and glucagon. Those are hormones. That's what makes it an endocrine gland. But it's also an exocrine gland, which means it secretes other stuff through ducts, not into the bloodstream, but onto some surface. In this case, it's the inner surface of the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine. So there are all kinds of digestive enzymes collectively called pancreatic juice, but one component of the pancreatic juice is chymotrypsin, a proteolytic enzyme. By the time you get past the stomach into the first part of the small intestine, you no longer have nearly as low a pH. It goes from about 2 to a little over 7, which is the pH of most of the body, just a little bit over 7. And so you can see that chymotrypsin has a well-matched optimal pH for where it works as well. By the way, pepsin, notice, could still be working as an enzyme by the time that mixture of chyme from the stomach and the pepsin from the stomach gets to the small intestine, except by the time that mixture gets to the small intestine, the pH is now out of the range of functionality of pepsin. So pepsin just stops working, and pancreatic proteolytic enzymes, including chymotrypsin, have to take over the job working at that new pH. But the main idea of both of these opening slides is that any given enzyme is going to have an optimal pH and an optimal temperature. If you get above or below that set point, or that optimal value of either temperature or pH, you're going to have suboptimal performance. And that's mostly because of denaturation, change in shape. Slide 3 shows you why it's not simply a change in shape, though, when it comes to pH changes. We're looking at enzyme activity versus pH here again, and a standard little bell curve hump that could represent any given enzyme. The only difference would be where what pH the peak occurs at, but this just explains that part of the sensitivity of enzyme function to pH beyond the shape change that can occur is protonation or deprotonation status of functional groups that are parts of R groups or side chains of the amino acids or the amino acid residues in the polypeptide that makes up the enzyme. Right, you have all these R groups, whatever determined by whatever the sequence is. And remember, non-adjacent R groups come together in the tertiary structure at a place that is the business end of the enzyme, the active site. Well, some of those R groups, depending on what the amino acid residues are, some of those R groups can have carboxyl or amino groups on them, right? Depending on which of the 20 we're talking about. And at low pHs, the carboxyl group is protonated, like we've already talked about even in an earlier chapter, right? COOH, it still has that proton at low pH. That makes sense, right? Low pH means high acidity, which means excess of hydrogen ions. So it makes sense that hydrogen ions would be on the carboxyl under that situation, right? You increase the pH, the carboxyl of these certain R groups that might be part of the active site will lose that proton. They'll become deprotonated. And so that affects the interaction between that carboxyl and a substrate that is fitting into that active site at a place that includes that carboxyl. Well, it could be that it's improving it, right? That's why it's going up here. Maybe it needs to be deprotonated in that enzyme in order to have a good match between substrate and enzyme. But then if you continue to increase the pH, notice that it's going to deprotonate the amino groups of certain amino-containing R groups of residues. And that might decrease the affinity between substrate and enzyme. So it's, yes, shape is definitely important, but it's not just the shape. It's just a good point in general. Enzymes are not just about hand and glove, lock and key, great fit between substrate and enzyme. That fit really just makes it more probable, more likely, that many parts of the substrate will come in close contact with many parts of the enzyme. If there's not such a good fit, you'll have certain things come in contact, but the rest of it, they'll still be away from each other, right? Well, it's that coming into close contact that really matters for the establishment of all the non-covalent interactions that we keep talking about. Those interactions occur between substrate and enzyme and actually bring about the reduction in activation energy that allows the enzyme to operate as a catalyst. Okay? Let's go to four. This cartoon explains three major classes of what we call reversible inhibition. Reversible inhibition is just what you would guess it is from the phrase. It means inhibition that is only temporary, can be reversed because whatever is causing the inhibition, the inhibitor particle, doesn't stay there permanently. It can pop on, pop off at any given moment. Actually, at the top, we don't have any inhibition at all. We just simply have the standard Michaelis-Menten model of an enzyme binding its substrate at the active site. Okay, so that's just, A is no inhibition at all. We've already talked about that. But then we have B, C, and D, the three major classes of reversible inhibition. And the first of these is competitive inhibition. Now, this phrase makes sense because a substrate is not able to be turned into product by binding to just any place on the surface of an enzyme, right? It specifically has to bind to the active site of the enzyme in order for it to be transformed into product. And so it's competition for that active site that gives competitive inhibition its name. If there is no competition, substrate will bind to the active site if there's an enzyme available. But if you also throw into the mix some particle that is not the actual natural substrate for that enzyme, but is similar to it in shape and chemical properties, at least part of that inhibitor is going to be enough like the part of the substrate that fits into the active site of the enzyme, that it could fit into the active site instead of the substrate fitting in there. In other words, the inhibitor and the substrate are competing for one available active site on any given enzyme. Now, the competitive inhibitor is not a substrate, even though it fits in there well, because to be a substrate, it needs to be transformed in the process, right, into a product. That doesn't happen. The inhibitor doesn't get transformed into a product. All it does, really, is occupy that enzyme so that a substrate cannot occupy it, at least for the moment, because we're talking about reversible inhibition here for all three of these examples. So the next moment, that inhibitor might pop back off and allow a substrate in. But for the moment, however long it is that that inhibitor is there, that enzyme is just might as well not even be there, right? It's not working as a catalyst at that moment because it's not transforming any substrate into product. The one very important thing about competitive inhibition, other than its definition, which I just told you, is that it's a type of inhibition that can be overcome by an increase in substrate concentration. If you have a given population, some certain number of inhibitors in the area, they're inhibiting, right? Whenever they bind to an active site, they're inhibiting that particular enzyme. If you keep that population as is, the inhibitor population, but you just drastically increase the substrate concentration, just the fact that they vastly outnumber the inhibitors mean that they're going to win out the competition, basically, more often than not. There's just more of them around. So you can basically overwhelm an inhibitor with an increase in substrate concentration and get back to where you were before there was any inhibition to begin with. That's not true of C and D, the next two types of inhibition. neither one of the B or I mean C or D can be overcome by addition of substrate. C, though, is a picture of uncompetitive inhibition. Now, be careful with C and D here, but one of them is called uncompetitive and one of them is called non-competitive. Linguistically, those mean the same thing, right? But you have to remember which one's which, because they are different in terms of what's happening, actually, in the definition. They're also different in terms of their kinetics, which we'll talk about after this slide. So in uncompetitive inhibition, what's happening is that the inhibitor, whatever kind of particle that inhibitor is, which is the blue thing on this, it's not able to bind to enzyme by itself. When you have enzyme by itself, what I mean by enzyme by itself is just an enzyme that's not bound to anything else, just an empty enzyme. The shape isn't correct to fit the inhibitor. But a substrate, if it's available, can bind to the open enzyme, right? And substrate is an example of a ligand, like I've said several times. And in general, what happens when a ligand binds to a protein? Change in shape. We've already talked about that in terms of induced fit, right? Well, in this case, the change in shape of the enzyme that results from the binding of the substrate to the active site causes the ability of the uncompetitive inhibitor in blue to bind to that enzyme. It creates another little binding site that wasn't there to begin with, without the substrate, and now the inhibitor can bind as well. So even though the substrate is there in the active site, the fact that the inhibitor comes along and binds there is going to at least slow down the transformation of substrate into product, if not halt it altogether. It might prevent the transformation, and so you just have substrate staying as substrate there, bound to the enzyme, or it could drastically reduce it. Neither way, it's an inhibition of the enzyme, right? It's turning it down or off. But it's like all these three examples, that's reversible. So if the inhibitor pops off, then the substrate can be transformed into product again. All right, now the bottom one, non-competitive inhibition, is a little different. And it's clearly seen on the cartoon version here. In non-competitive inhibition, it's not a place near the active site where the inhibitor binds. So it's just like in allosteric inhibition that we talked about before. Some totally different place on the enzyme is a binding site for the non-competitive inhibitor. And it could bind either to an empty enzyme or it could bind to an enzyme-substrate complex. In other words, the inhibitor can come along first or the substrate can come along first, but in either case, the inhibitor can bind. And as long as that inhibitor is bound, it's going to prevent catalysis. It could be that the inhibitor can bind and prevent the substrate from either even coming in at later and fitting, or if the substrate makes it there first, depending on the enzyme. Substrate gets there first, the inhibitor getting there second can prevent the catalysis, and therefore it's functionally similar to what's happening in uncompetitive inhibition. All right? Any questions on the difference between these three? These are all reversible. So none of these stays in this state very long. But when you think about a population of millions of enzyme molecules in solution and inhibitors and substrate molecules, thinking about just one at a time is really a representative of what happens as a proportion of that population. Well, I included slide five just to say that competitive inhibitors aren't necessarily bad things, depending on what's happening here. I mean, viewed from the viewpoint of the substrate, I guess it's always bad because the substrate wants to get in there and become product. But competitive inhibition can be exploited usefully, like in the case of sulfanilamide, which was an early sulfa drug used as an antibiotic. Notice the similarity structurally between sulfanilamide and PABA. P-aminobutyric acid is what that stands for. It's just an acronym. Doesn't matter, though. The PABA is the natural substrate of a bacterial enzyme. PABA gets transformed into folic acid, or it's in the pathway that leads to the production of folic acid. Bacteria need folic acid for exactly the same reason we do, basically all organisms. It's an important cofactor for other enzymes to operate, right? Because we've talked about cofactors before. So unless the enzymes are activated by cofactors, the enzymes you might as well not have them, and therefore the reactions that they catalyze aren't going to happen that will kill the bacterium or any other cell, for that matter. Bacteria make their own folic acid, though, which is one reason why we depend on bacteria. There's all kinds of reasons why we absolutely cannot live without bacteria, but they make a bunch of vitamins for us. We just have to eat the stuff that they make. Well, they don't go around eating stuff that has folic acid in it. They have to make their own. And so since we don't have to make our own, we just get it in our diet, this stuff doesn't affect us. We don't have the enzymes to make folic acid. We never make our own folic acid, which is why it's a vitamin, right? But a bacterium does, and therefore if you shut down the enzyme by filling the active site with something that's very similar to PABA, sulfanilamide, you basically prevent that enzyme from producing folic acid for the bacterium, and it kills it. Kills it without affecting us. That's the hallmark of a good antibiotic, right? So some drugs act by competitive inhibition. All right, now I want you to think back to whatever chapter I guess it was the last chapter that had the Michaelis-Menten graphs and the double reciprocal plots, whatever chapter it was, one or two ago. I said that we were going to revisit those. And here's where we're going to revisit them. For each of the three categories of reversible inhibition that we just discussed, I'll show you a hyperbolic graph and a double reciprocal plot, which are also called Lineweaver-Burk plots, by the way. A Lineweaver-Burk plot is that double reciprocal plot. And this is where, even though I said in modern days we don't really use the double reciprocal plot so much to figure out what Vmax or Km are, because we can just directly use a computer fit to a hyperbolic trace, there's still a modern utility to the Lineweaver-Burk plots, and that's to quickly get, by glancing at it, get a feel for whether the enzyme in question is operating via, is being inhibited competitively, uncompetitively, or non-competitively. That's what these next six slides will be about. So in six, we have an example of competitive inhibition. I mean, we have the relative rate versus substrate concentration. So this is relative rate is velocity, right? Velocity versus substrate concentration, like we've seen in other plots. Standard hyperbolic shape, and it's asymptotically approaching Vmax, like we've talked about, correct? That's the black trace. No inhibitor present. It just works as a normal Michaelis-Menten enzyme. No new information there. All the green traces, though, show the same general shape, but with an inhibitor present. And so there's three different concentrations of inhibitors. Otherwise, it's the same. So you have the same amount of enzyme in all cases, black and all green. But for each of the greens, you're adding more and more inhibitor to that population of enzyme and substrate. And what I've told you already, when we looked at the cartoon versions of the definitions, you can now see graphically. What I'm talking about is that competitive inhibition does not change. I mean, it can be overwhelmed by addition of substrate. That's what I said earlier. And that's because Vmax does not change. Notice that these green lines don't get as high as quickly. I shouldn't say quickly because that implies time. With the same substrate concentration. But if you keep extending these out, notice they're going to the same Vmax. So in competitive inhibition does not decrease Vmax. Okay? What about Km, though? You have to think back to what Km is, graphically speaking. Right. Km, remember, is the substrate concentration at which the enzyme is operating at exactly half Vmax. So Vmax is the same for all these three traces. That's this high, right? Halfway there is about right here. Where that meets the black line, the X value of that, which is the substrate concentration, that is the Km, that's much lower than it is for any of these green traces at the same half of Vmax, right? So competitive inhibition increases Km, but does not affect Vmax. By the way, in case you're wondering what the top thing is all about, this is just a representation of the relationship, the dynamics between the enzyme, the substrate, and the inhibitor. E for enzyme, I for inhibitor, S for substrate, obviously. So on the upper left corner of that schematic, you have all three separate particles, not yet interacting, right? E, S, and I, each on their own, on its own. If inhibitor interacts with the enzyme blocking the active site, then you make the enzyme inhibitor complex, which is a dead end in terms of production of product, right? Or at least a temporary dead end. Because the inhibitor can pop back off, it's a reversible reaction, and substrate can replace it. Or substrate can come in to begin with before the inhibitor gets there and bind to the enzyme, as the top pink traces show. As long as you have substrate and enzyme coming together, you have an enzyme-substrate complex that's formed, and that then becomes catalyzed into enzyme and product now on their own. So that's what the symbols mean, and they're similar symbols in the next couple slides. Let's go to 7 now and look at uncompetitive inhibition. So remember I said that in uncompetitive inhibition, the substrate has to come along first and bind to the enzyme before the inhibitor is able to bind. And this is where the schematic that's on the top, I think, is misleading in this book. Because you have enzyme, substrate, and inhibitor all on their own, which is true. But the way it's drawn, it's almost seeming like substrate and inhibitor come together. Really what's happening is the substrate and the enzyme are coming together to form ES, the enzyme-substrate complex. And once that's formed, then the inhibitor is allowed in. And that's why you then have enzyme-substrate inhibitor complex, ESI, on the bottom. That's a dead end with respect to product formation. Okay, but it is reversible, hence the double arrows. So as long as it gets reversed, as long as the inhibitor pops back off, then you can proceed as normally as you would have without the presence of the inhibitor and go to enzyme and product. Kinetically, though, in the trace on the bottom, what do you see about this? What pops out as the importance of this graph on the bottom? Vmax is decreased, right? For uncompetitive inhibition, Vmax is decreased. Whereas it was not in competitive inhibition. So each of these asymptotes is different from the other one. It keeps getting lower the more and more inhibitor you add. But that's not the only thing that's actually changed. Vmax is decreased, but actually Km is also decreased. Km, remember, was increased in competitive inhibition. Km actually gets decreased in uncompetitive inhibition, which is kind of confusing and kind of counterintuitive. But what's really happening is that as enzyme substrate complex is taken out because the inhibitor comes along, ESI is different stuff chemically compared to ES. So effectively, when you make some ESI by the inhibitor binding to the enzyme substrate complex, you're taking some enzyme substrate out, right? And by Le Chatelier's principle, when you take product away, that's going to shift the reaction to the right, correct? To make up for the for what you're taking out. So that means more enzyme and substrate will interact to reestablish the equilibrium. And that has the effect of reducing KM. What's really happening is that some substrate gets tied up being in the ESI, which is useless. So the same KM is really happening. I mean, the same amount of activity is actually happening at what ends up being a lower substrate concentration because of that wasted substrate. Hopefully that makes sense. But graphically, you can see that as just being Vmax is reduced, so the KM also actually gets reduced. Keep in mind that it's the KM is reduced, but that the KM is always the half maximum. Well, that maximum itself is being reduced. So yeah, the KM value is lower, but it actually corresponds to half of a lower Vmax as well. Okay, let's go to 8 then and look at non-competitive inhibition. Same thing. A little bit more complex schematic at the top. And that's simply because for non-competitive inhibition, the inhibitor can come along before the substrate, which you see occurring right here on the left edge. Inhibitor and enzyme can actually form an EI complex, and then a substrate can come along forming the ESI. Or the enzyme-substrate complex can form, and then the inhibitor can come along and form the ESI. So that describes the square part of the schematic. In either case, no matter how you get to the ESI, it's worthless, right, in terms of making product. It doesn't work, so it's a dead end. But as long as that inhibitor pops off, at least eventually, then you're back to ES, which transforms into enzyme and product for another round. The enzyme is recycled, of course. And so what pops out from the graph? What is it? Yes, just like for uncompetitive inhibition, non-competitive inhibition features a lower Vmax. KM, though, actually stays the same, which is not, you can't really see it from this graph too well because there's not enough detail in it or not enough resolution in it. But KM is being maintained in non-competitive inhibition. Vmax is being reduced. Okay? Well, let's look at the corresponding Lineweaver-Burk plots, or the double reciprocal plots, for each of these three in order. Starting with slide 9, which is competitive inhibition. Keep in mind how the Lineweaver-Burk plots operate. You're not plotting velocity versus substrate concentration. Instead, you're plotting the reciprocal of velocity versus the reciprocal of substrate concentration. 1 over V versus 1 over bracket S. Okay, that is what a Lineweaver-Burk plot is. And also remember from the first time I showed you this that you have the reason you do this is not just to linearize it. That's the main reason, originally, why we were doing this. But you also get some important points, specific points from that graph. The y-intercept, the B part of the y equals mx plus B form, gives you 1 over Vmax. So that gives you a way to figure out Vmax, right? That was the original intent. But remember I said that there's still a modern good reason to use these Lineweaver-Burk plots, and that's to quickly make it obvious which kind of competition we're looking at. Because when we remember, let's quickly review what's happening in competitive inhibition. What's happening to KM and Vmax? Vmax is the same, right? And you see that right here. The pink trace is inhibited. The black trace is uninhibited. They both share the same value of the y-intercept. So Vmax must be the same in order for 1 over Vmax to be the same. Okay, so it just pivots at that point. And what else? What's true of Km? What happens to Km? It increases, right? Now, remember that the x-intercept, the place where the extrapolation hits the x-axis on a Lineweaver-Burk plot, is negative 1 over Km. So the bigger that gets, the bigger Km gets, I should say, the closer that gets to 0, right? Because you're dividing by Km. So that makes sense. Km is bigger. And so that is the general shape that would tell you, if you didn't know what kind of inhibition it is, this spells out immediately competitive inhibition. That's the main use nowadays of these Lineweaver-Burk plots. On the other hand, in slide 10, we're looking at uncompetitive. And remember, in uncompetitive, that Vmax changes, but so does Km. They change proportionately. Well, what is the slope equal to on a what is the slope equal to on a Lineweaver-Burk plot? Do you remember? Km over Vmax. Good. Exactly. So if Km and Vmax are both changing by the same factor, then Km divided by Vmax is really going to be the same thing, right? In other words, the slope of the Lineweaver-Burk plot does not change. And if you have the same slope in two different lines graphically, that really just means you have parallel lines, right? The inhibited line and the uninhibited line have the same slope. They are therefore parallel. If you do a Lineweaver-Burk plot and you see that parallel line, that shows you that's uncompetitive inhibition. And notice that Km, by the way, it's called Km with APP as a superscript. That just means the apparent Km. It's the Km now in the presence of the inhibitor. The apparent Km is different from the original Km, the uninhibited. But notice it's to the left now, which means Km got smaller. Right, because negative 1 over Km is to the left. And Vmax is changed as well. It's gotten lower, right? 1 over Vmax gets bigger. All right, and then correspondingly, slide 11 is non-competitive inhibition. And remember, the hallmark of that in terms of the kinetics is that, well, what happens to Vmax? What do you see from this plot? Vmax decreases, Km stays the same, so it's pivoting here at Km rather than at Vmax like in the competitive inhibition plot. Okay, so when you see this shape in a Lineweaver-Burk plot, it shows you that it's non-competitive inhibition. Everyone clear on those three, the differences? Yeah. Because it really, in non-competitive inhibition, it really amounts to some of the enzyme just being rendered worthless. And therefore, what you're really doing with the inhibitor is just diluting the concentration of enzyme that's there. And when you have fewer enzyme molecules that are able to operate for the substrate, the effect is that you're not going to really have a change in Km. You're just only going to affect Vmax. Okay, now all of that stuff, all those three major categories, like I said a couple times, are reversible inhibition, but we wouldn't bother to call it reversible inhibition if there weren't such a thing as irreversible inhibition as well. And so the remaining slides in this chapter are about that. Irreversible inhibition can be literally irreversible, meaning it's permanent change, but it could also just be effectively irreversible, meaning it lasts so long that it's just much longer than reversible. Irreversible inhibition involves a much higher likelihood of covalent interaction, covalent bonding between inhibitor and enzyme. And that should make sense based on just what I said, right? covalent bonds, being much stronger, are going to be more permanent and therefore more irreversible than the fleeting non-covalent interactions that reversible inhibition features. Okay, so functionally speaking, even though they're all irreversible reactions, we're going to talk, irreversible inhibition. Functionally, we can categorize those four different ways. And the first one we're seeing an example of right here in slide 12. The first example is inhibitors that are called specific group reagents. Now, groups here are functional groups. Remember, functional groups occur on just about all these molecules that are in biochemistry. But there are things like carbonyls, hydroxyls, whatever. The functional groups are important because they give that molecule whatever its function is. Well, there are functional groups on R groups, side chains, R groups of amino acid residues. So in the active site, there are functional groups, right? Depends on what the actual amino acid residues are as to what the functional groups are, but any given active site is going to feature some functional groups. Well, these specific group reagents are just chemicals that will easily react with a certain kind of functional group. And maybe those functional groups are part of the active site, maybe not. If they're not part of the active site, it's likely that that reagent might not even affect the enzyme. But if that functional group or several examples of it are within the active site, then a specific group reagent is going to form some sort of reaction, or it's going to undergo some sort of reaction with those functional groups, changing the enzyme, changing it into an inactive form. Okay, so it's not really so much that these specific group reagents are shaped just like the normal substrate. They are just interacting with a tiny little place within the active site. It's not like a lock and key mechanism. But they're messing with some important part of that active site, and therefore they drastically affect the enzyme. You see that happening right here when this DIPF, which is the reagent, interacts with the hydroxyl of a serine residue. So there's all kinds of amino acids represented by this yellow ribbon, right? This is just the active site of the enzyme. But right here in this position, you happen to have a serine, which has a hydroxyl on it. This DIPF reagent reacts with that hydroxyl, covalently changing the enzyme. You now have an enzyme with that reagent stuck onto it, and therefore it doesn't do its job as an enzyme. So that's specific group reagents. Slides 13 and 14 show you an example of what we call substrate analogs. Here, analog refers to the fact that you have some sort of chemical that is very similar in shape or in chemistry or both to the actual substrate. And if it comes along, since it's allowed to fit in there nicely, just like the regular substrate does, it can bring in a reactive group that's actually going to change that enzyme. So you have the natural substrate for chymotrypsin, which is a polypeptide or part of at least an oligopeptide, some amino acids strung together still. It's going to cleave the peptide bond between them, right? That's what its normal job is. Well, this thing is shaped very similarly. It has similar ring structure, but it also has stuck on it this pink reactive group, and that's what's going to disable the enzyme, as you see it happening in slide 14. The TPCK is the substrate analog. It is similar enough to the actual substrate that it'll go in there to the active site, but it's now going to permanently change the enzyme. So functionally, these are subtle differences. They're all really changing the enzyme in some way. But the subtle difference here is that substrate analogs are much more like the actual substrate than a specific group reagent is. Specific group reagent is just going in there looking for a specific kind of functional group. 15 is a cartoon that doesn't show you much if you don't know what it's talking about. This is a representation of what is called peptidoglycan, which is the major component of a bacterial cell wall. Bacterial cell walls are important for the same reason that any organism that has cell walls, it's important for, which is to maintain pressure, osmotic pressure, right? Animal cells don't have cell walls, which is why they can undergo lysis if there's too much osmotic pressure, right? You put a red blood cell into pure water, it's going to burst because it doesn't have that cell wall to hold the pressure in. A bacterium doesn't want to lose its only one, the only cell it has. So it has a cell wall to hold the pressure in. And that pressure is really maintained by this network of protein and sugar. Peptidoglycan is part sugar, part protein, that entirely covers the plasma membrane. So it's external to the plasma membrane, as you'd expect for a cell wall. The reason it works as a kind of a mesh is because these vertical strands are then locked together by interaction between adjacent strands, forming a mesh. Okay? Well, there obviously that this doesn't just pop into existence. There's enzymes that are responsible for making these covalent linkages between the adjacent strands to make the overall complex polymer. And penicillin, the original antibiotic, disrupts the enzyme that makes that peptidoglycan. That's how penicillin worked originally so well before we overused it and caused enough selection pressure to cause all kinds of problems with evolution of antibiotic resistance, right? But when these things were still vulnerable, and some still are, of course, but when they were really vulnerable early on, it was because the enzyme that they need to build that cell wall was being inactivated by a third category of reversible enzymes. I mean, irreversibly inhibited enzymes. And that third category is suicide inhibitors, as they're called. The reason they're called suicide inhibitors is because the enzyme actually kind of takes an active role in inactivating itself. Of course, the inhibitor is necessary as well. But here you have an even better fit between the inhibitor and the active site. It's very similar to the actual substrate. So it fits in there nicely, but the interaction does not produce the normal product, right? Because it's not the normal substrate. It's such a good fit, though, that the enzyme actually does transform that inhibitor into something else. Just like it would transform the substrate into a product. But in this case, it transforms it into something that basically permanently disables that enzyme. Yeah. Not a better fit than the original substrate. A better fit between the inhibitor and the active site for a suicide inhibitor than there is between a substrate analog, which is another type of inhibitor, and its active site. So as we go through these, there's a better and better fit between the inhibitor and the actual active site, basically. But they're all irreversible. Okay? So that's how it works. Penicilloyl enzyme complex is the permanently, irreversibly inactivated enzyme, and therefore it can't make the peptidoglycan, the cell wall can't be produced, and you can't make new bacteria. Slide 17 is the final one in this chapter, and that's the fourth category of irreversible inhibition, which is called transition state analog rather than substrate analog. Think back to how any given enzyme works, right? You have a substrate, you have an enzyme, you make an enzyme-substrate complex, but an enzyme operates by transforming that substrate not directly into product, but first into a transition state that's at the highest energy level, right? Like we talked about on the graphs. You have to get over that hill. In fact, that's true whether it's catalyzed or not. Reactant doesn't just turn immediately into product. It turns into that very brief transition state that's halfway between reactant and product, right? That transition state is really the best fit possible between an enzyme and the active site. The fit, remember we talked about induced fit, the substrate coming there to originally, will cause an even better fit. But then as that substrate gets transformed into transition state, that is truly a tight interaction between the enzyme and that transition state, which is what allows it to get over that hump, basically, and then go downhill from there to the product. That's what happens normally when you're using a normal substrate. When you have a transition state analog, it's called that because it's very, very similar, not to the substrate, but to the transition state. And so it's a very powerful inhibitor of the enzyme because there is such a close interaction between any given enzyme and the transition state of the reaction that it catalyzes. So it basically just locks it into this transition state enzyme, transition state analog enzyme complex and takes it out of commission. Okay? That is one chapter.